Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Hi, welcome to the Kudzu Vine for June 19th, 2016. I'm your host, David McLaughlin. Joining me as always, welcome Catherine Smith.
Greetings from Atlanta.
And welcome Tim Shiflett.
Good evening.
Yes, good to have y'all both on, and it's going to be great to have on our guest here in about 20 minutes. From the Monkey Cage blog, which is now part of the Washington Post, and a professor at George Washington University, Dr. John Sides will appear this week. He was so kind to come back on after our technical difficulties a few weeks ago, and everything's looking really good on the board. Got three bars on the phone, so hopefully, fingers crossed, all that technical part will come off without a glitch so we can hear the great analysis of Dr. Sides. But until then, wanted to lead off with a national topic, and that was all week long, including today, I saw more articles or more stories talking about how Republicans are still really not wanting to accept Donald Trump as their nominee. You know, Lamar Alexander, you know, said, well, he's not the nominee yet, like there was something that could be done. Paul Ryan said that he just sets the rules, that the delegates are not don't have to, you know, choose whatever nominee. Everybody in the Republican Party, or not, I don't say everybody, but a good number of leaders of the Republican Party seem to think that there's another path to another nominee other than Donald Trump. Catherine, what do you make of this?
You know, the more he talks, the more it frightens me that they're going to try to figure something out to get somebody else in there, but I don't know who that would be.
Well, and if they do, they have the backlash of their party. And I was talking a little bit on pre-show. Let's say you take this and you throw out the results and of the open primary, states like Georgia, where the, you know, local and state governments pay for elections, and you just cast aside the results and, oh, it didn't count. You've almost frauded the government in a way by having this election that had no validity or meaning. And so I think that could be a real concern. But Tim, I think you've done some analysis. You know, you've seen the path that this could happen, even if it's not something you think is very likely. Kind of go through that scenario.
Well, it would take a lot. There is a little movement started among delegates. There's a lady by the name of Kendall Unruh from Colorado. She obviously is the leader of this effort, and her idea is to introduce a conscience clause. It would take a rules change, and the conscience clause would just simply state that a delegate who could not in good conscience support whoever they were there bound to on the first ballot would be released from that binding and could then vote their conscience. Now, what would have to happen there, first of all, is it would have to pass the Rules Committee. There's 112 people on the Rules Committee. It would take 57 of them to pass it, just so it could get to the convention floor, where a majority of the 2,472 delegates would then have to go along with the rule change. And there's just no way. So far, Ms. Unruh says she has 10 members of the Rules Committee. And the media can identify her and one other lady from Colorado, who was a Cruz delegate anyway, and that's it. So I don't see any way that this is going to happen. You would have chaos at the convention. The party would explode. The man easily won fair and square. I'm not happy that he's the nominee, but he's going to be the nominee. They are so confident of his people are his delegate counters, that they're not even paying any attention to this. So, you know what, guys, more important than that, I think, is let's see how many defections there will be from, you know, some of the big names in the party. We already know the Bush about the Bushes, and we know that, like Governor Hogan up there in Maryland, much has been made of the fact that he just said he wasn't going to support Trump. And there's a few others just slipping in here and there, like I think a mayor of a city in West Virginia who's a Republican, you know, people like that. Let's see how many defections he has and how that damages the party. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Fred Upton, congressman from, you know, Michigan's a holdout. Lindsey Graham, I think, is still a holdout. Tim, you mentioned the number 10 she's got. Now, I watched the finals game from Quicken Loans Arena the other day, and that arena looked pretty big. 10's not really going to make a big difference with a number that large, correct?
Well, I mean, when you're talking about 10 people out of 112 members of the Rules Committee is what I'm talking about. That's still not a very big number because you have to have 57. And when the media can only substantiate that there's two, and one of them is the lady who's making the claim that there's 10, you see what I'm saying?
It don't
look too promising.
Well, let me ask you this. There's so many facets to this, and one, you mentioned a conscience clause. Now,
right.
Catherine, I'll let you answer my question. I'm a postulate. Really, if you're talking about in good conscience, if your party, the Republican Party, when a lot of candidates won the race, a nice plurality supported Donald Trump, when the race got down to about three, a majority supported Donald Trump, isn't it, you know, your good conscience to support the will of your party, even if you don't like that will?
Well, I mean, I think that's what you do when you agree to be a delegate, is that you agree to, you know, vote with the, you know, constituents of your delegation, of the delegation that you, or of the group that you represent. I agree with you. I don't see how they can, in good conscience, not select him as their nominee. I get that, you know, I understand the good conscience in a general sense that you don't think he would be a very good president or you don't think that he's qualified or whatever. But I think you also have to weigh the conscience of the people that you're there to represent. So it's going to be an interesting convention, I think.
Yeah, well, Tim, I'm going to ask you another question off of this. Paul Ryan gives these people hopes with his statement. Lamar Alexander gives these people hopes with his statement. Why are two leaders of the Republican Party, two adult leaders of the Republican Party, if you will, giving folks like this hope, where realistically there's not much?
Because they want to wait and see which way the political wind blows. If this thing goes downhill badly in the fall, they can distance themselves from the nominee, kind of like they cut Bob Dole loose, you might remember late. Well, I don't know if you'd remember, David, but late in 76, in 96, right? They cut him loose. And to save, you know, the Senate and the House. And that's what Ryan and Alexander would be interested in doing. Now, as far as Ryan, you know, he'll be the guy running the convention. He's not going to be, you know, out there promoting a rules change. He may not say nothing publicly, but he's not going to be out there promoting a change in the rules that's 40 years old at least. And you would have to say the only reason these rules are being changed is because the people that are trying to change it didn't like the result. Now, is there any other reason that they're doing this?
No, it's sour grapes.
Yeah, well, let me ask y'all this then. Is it not the Republican Party that should look itself in the mirror and go, it's our voters, our core supporters, that gave us Donald Trump? You know, what does this say about us as a party? Isn't that the bigger question, the more sobering question that has to be answered by Republican leaders like Paul, like Paul Ryan, Catherine?
Well, of course, but they're not going to be, you know, they're not going to be that reflective, at least not in public. I mean, they might be having those conversations behind the scenes, but they're not going to be talking about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's to me the question they've got to face. Well, another question, and Tim, I'll give you this one. Tim, if a lot of the delegates really don't support the candidacy of Donald Trump, but they're kind of boxed into the roles, and there's only, you know, eight ladies apparently, or eight people or whatever it is, 10 people wanting to change it, and there's not enough. But then Donald Trump gets to pick a vice presidential nominee. If they're kind of cool to this nominee, really, or she doesn't really excite them, is there a way that they could just say no to Donald Trump's nominee, force a vice VP nominee on Donald Trump as a way of revolting within the rules?
Well, technically, they could, vote on the convention floor not to accept, you know, his person. But if he picks anyone, you know, just halfway credible, and I've got to think at least he's going to do that much, you know, somebody like, you know, maybe Christie or Newt Gingrich or something. You know, those people will be acceptable. I don't see how they could help but be acceptable. Look, we may be sitting here talking about all of this wild stuff that may happen and then their convention go off without a hitch. He's been fooling us for a year. And I still don't want to sell him too short here. Just saying.
Yeah, but this is a party that last time had a calm, professional nominee, and yet the convention,
yep, but,
the meme of the convention was an old guy talking to a chair. This time you've got a loose cannon like Donald Trump,
yeah,
running the show. Can it get any better than what Mitt Romney had?
Well, I mean, I don't know. It's just hard to say. I've got to think Donald Trump, if he remains Donald Trump, that's bad for them, obviously. But we also got to remember that it was just the perfect storm that gave this guy the chance to be the nominee. If there wasn't 19 people running, he wouldn't have been the nominee because he didn't get a majority of the vote. He got a plurality of the vote. But with all those people in the race, that's all he did. So, you know.
Well, early on he did. Now, when it was down to three and you had a big conservative leader like Cruz, you had a much more mainstream person like Kasich. I mean, I think Kasich would have been a light years better nominee than Donald Trump or most anybody of that group.
But by then it was over. It really was. By then, it was over.
Well, Catherine, since that's such a juicy question, I'm going to give you a chance at that one, too. Do you think the delegates of the Republican Party would assert their authority by bucking the trend of whoever Donald Trump picked as vice president?
I think Tim makes a good point. If it's someone, you know, with a legitimate track record in the Republican Party, either as an elected official or as a, some other kind of leader, I just don't see how they could resist that, right? I mean, how can you say no to Chris Christie? I mean, obviously you can, but I'm trying to remember, what was the name of his TV show?
Trump.
Yeah.
The Apprentice.
The Apprentice. Yeah,
the Maybe Apprentice. They'll do an Apprentice-style vice presidential pick. And instead of ending with you're fired, you're hired and you're the vice presidential candidate. It could be really good TV, right? They could do it like they could start it on the first night of the convention, give them some stupid assignment like they did on the show, and then, you know, as it goes on, they narrow it down to the winner.
Yeah, I mean, it would be great TV. I mean, there's no doubt. He'd love to do it. Speaking of The Apprentice, did y'all see where Arnold Schwarzenegger, he's going to take over The Apprentice. That's old news. But he is kind of coming out repudiating Donald Trump, which not so much that he's a Republican, Donald Trump's a Republican, but the fact that he's kind of taken over his apprentice mantle, you think that he would kind of stay quiet about criticizing the Donald, at least until a season's in the can, if you will. Did y'all hear about that?
Yes.
I just don't think Arnold Schwarzenegger can keep quiet about too much if he's asked.
Yeah, I mean, he's moved on from politics, and he's back into movies. Now he's going to do The Apprentice for whatever it's worth. I didn't know why they had to choose him because of that scandal he had. Tim?
No, I was about to say that wherever Trump is having a rally, one of the attendees tried to disarm a police officer. Stuff like that goes on everywhere this guy goes. It's just his rallies are like lunacy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, did they say what the motivation for that was?
No. I just saw the header and it's kind of breaking news, so. I'm sure they'll get around to talking more about it later. So
more facts about it will come out soon. Well, before our guest comes on in, I guess we got like 2 or 3 minutes. Yesterday they selected the convention chair for the Democratic Party, who will represent the Democratic Party, I guess be the person to say the state of Georgia cast its X number of delegates for. And I guess what made that noteworthy is you had the DPG chair, DeBose Porter, who – you know, apparently Catherine was kind of informing us that's not always the case. It's not always the chair that runs. But he ran against a Bernie Sanders supporter. He turned back that challenge kind of 3-1. Catherine, what more can you tell us about all this?
Well, I wasn't there, and I don't know all the details that went on. There was some discussion apparently about the fact that, you know, the primary voters and or the majority voters in Georgia are African American women, and that white men are not really, you know, Georgia Democratic voters, and that there should be representation that that better reflects the voting bloc in the party. That seemed to be the core question about DuBose versus this woman who I don't know anything about. I don't even know her name. I think her name was Julie. But that seemed to be the question that people raised. And I heard that there was a nomination of someone, a well-respected African-American woman who was not present and was called to see if she was willing to run, and she chose not to. You know, I think it was supposed to last an hour, and it lasted like six.
Six so, hours. Well, and
I don't know. It was longer than an hour. I think it was four or five hours. Pardon?
Yeah. And the AJC did report that they talked about Shirley Franklin.
Yeah,
she did
not
want
to
be the convention chair.
Yeah, I knew that, but I didn't know if it was public.
Yeah, it's on public. This is an AJC's article. But they did talk about, she's on one of the platform committees, so therefore, you know, she'll be there. Maybe, and it could even be a conflict where you can't serve as whatever platform committee chairperson she is and a state delegation committee. I don't know if that's the case, but then more likely than not, she just didn't want to, embarrass or get involved with this race with DuBose Porter. Tim, what do you make all this?
Well, all over the country, I would imagine Sanders supporters are trying to do this sort of thing. And I can see why they want to parlay themselves into a position where they can exert some influence over the rules process at the convention. They feel like because of the race he ran that they've earned that. And so I imagine this is probably playing out in more states than Georgia, wouldn't you?
I would think that there would be some of these kind of things going. Georgia's probably not a very good territory because, you know, Hillary Clinton won Georgia by a very, very healthy margin, maybe not the most,
uh-huh.
but in the top quarter of all states, probably one of her biggest victories as far as number of votes, given that Georgia's a larger state than, say, Mississippi, where she may have had a bigger margin. So it just didn't like it, the best attempt, and it failed. I did see that Vincent Fort was involved in this. Do either one of y'all know much about what State Senator Fort was getting involved with this? Because there's somebody that did support Bernard Sanders during the process.
I don't know what he said or did, but, you know, he likes to stir things up. That's sort of his MO. So.
Yeah.
And he is running for mayor,
yeah.
So, you know,
he is
he's
running for
trying
mayor.
To get some attention, I suppose.
Yeah. Tim, what have you heard of this?
No, I haven't heard anything about State Senator Fort's involvement. I've heard that he said some things, but as far as his involvement in what went on yesterday, no, I've not heard anything about this.
Yes. Well, let's see if we can get into the topic in during the time we've got. And it turned into the Florida Senate race. Now, a few weeks ago, we heard read the articles, the rumor that, you know, could Marco Rubio look at rejoining or seeking his current seat for the U.S. Senate? And at that time, it didn't like it was very likely. You had David Jolly as the leading candidate on the Republican side. And now some polls have been taken. David Jolly has backed out of the U.S. Senate race. Now he's looking to run for his old congressional seat. And Marco Rubio is talking about the tragedy in Orlando as being maybe a catalyst or reason he must continue serving. When all said and done, Catherine, do you think Marco Rubio is going to run?
I can't tell you how irritating it is to me that he's using the tragedy in Orlando to, you know, leverage his potential re-entry or entry into that race. You know, I can't even talk about him. I'm sorry. I don't have an opinion. I just think it's
okay.
It's shocking. You know, he's
well. Catherine, I'm going to try to put some words in your mouth, and you can agree or disagree. I think after 9/11, a lot of people decided to join the military. They decided to run for public office. They did other things to support their country, and they just decided to do that. And there, it's not that people can't decide to do things because of what happened in Orlando. I'm sure as time goes on, we're going to hear people say, you know, what happened that day in Orlando made me want to get involved because of this. And we're going to think that's good. It's just the fact that Marco Rubio was pretty clearly already looking for this or looking at this. So it seems calculated. Catherine, have I put the wrong words in your mouth, or
yes.
have I put something?
No, that's
close?
Right. That's exactly. Plus, he's no fan or supporter of the LGBT community. So I just, it just burns me.
Yeah. Tim, what are your thoughts on Marco Rubio coming back to the Senate?
You know, I'm not surprised. The Orlando tragedy obviously gave him his opening to do so, and so here he came. You know, Representative Jolly is a friend of Rubio's, and he's now dropped back down to his old House seat to run against Charlie Crist. I guess we'll know everything for certain on, June the 24th, when they have to declare in Florida whether or not they're running. But think about this. He lost to Donald Trump badly there by, what, nearly 20 points? It may depend on who his general election opponent is, but in any case, I've got to say that Rubio has to start as a slight favorite on name recognition alone, but the presidential race might really hurt him.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking he's probably at this point going to get in. You know, the National Republicans have really been trying to talk him into doing so to try to save that seat. Because they were going to lose it, especially if Murphy got the nomination. So there we are.
Yeah, I think that Tampa Bay Tribune posted a poll that showed that if Alan Grayson is the Democratic nominee, then Marco Rubio could definitely go in as the favorite. If it's Patrick Murphy, not so much. I mean, it's Patrick Murphy still ahead of Marco Rubio. Now, I think you're absolutely 100% right, Tim, that if this presidential race is going to impact this race, one, I think Patrick Murphy is going to be the nominee. And then if he's the nominee, then it's like a 50-50 toss-up. If you're an incumbent,
right,
you don't want to be in a 50-50 toss-up. And then he's kind of putting a lot of eggs in the Donald Trump basket. If Donald Trump is sort of credible, maybe Marco Rubio can run ahead of it and retain his seat. If Donald Trump continues to put together campaign week after campaign week,
yeah,
like the one we just saw, then he's going to go down at the hands of his arch enemy. They call him Little Marco.
Let's examine that for just a moment. Since Mr. Trump has done such a swell job of courting Hispanic voters so far, that might be just a wee bit of a problem unless every registered voter in the panhandle of Florida were to turn out for him. That state does not look demographically good at all for Donald Trump. I got to be honest about it. So I think that is one state where if he continues to be Donald Trump, he's going to drag the down ballot ticket down with him some. And let's face it, Marco Rubio needs to do well among Hispanic voters because he's Hispanic. So just saying, it's going to be tough to run down there with Trump at the head of the ticket, don't you think?
I think it'd be real tough. And you have to remember that didn't Donald Trump actually win Florida in the primary? He beat
David.
I believe our guest
is trying to call in.
I think I finally saw it. I've been hitting refresh like crazy. Of course, it's a holiday, so let's go ahead and go to that and welcome him on. Back on the Kudzu Vine for, I guess this may be the third appearance, Dr. John Sides. Welcome, John.
Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, glad to have you on. Well, first thing is, we've talked in the past about the Monkey Cage blog. I believe the times you were on before, the Monkey Cage was kind of its own entity. And since you've come on, it's been merged, purchased, whatever you want to say. You can tell us the specifics by the Washington Post. Kind of tell us
how that's changed things, being a part of such a great newspaper.
We moved to the Post in September 2013, and I think we are sort of I don't know how, we weren't purchased or anything like that. I think you could say we sort of formed a partnership of sorts where, you know, we kind of live on their site, and we benefit a lot from sort of a larger platform and from their brand. And, you know, I think the two things that's really done for us, one, of course, is it's expanded our audience greatly. There's just no contrast between, you know, being a small independent blog and being part of a major news organization. And then the second thing is it's made us, I think, a much more attractive outlet for political scientists and other social scientists who want to write about current events. And so, you know, we get a lot of submissions, you know, from folks who know a lot about everything from the presidential election to whether England's going to leave the European Union to, you know, any number of things. You know, I think we've had more than probably 1,600 different people write for us in the last almost 3 years. So that's been a real big asset for us because we can draw on a much larger range of expertise.
Oh, it makes total sense. Just like we're a podcast, we need eardrums. You want eyeballs.
Absolutely.
And I think we've had you on the past. You had written some books about the presidential election. You wrote one about 2012, which, you know, to every election deserves a book. But I can only imagine if you're planning a book this year, the type of material you're getting together. So let's just start right out there, John. Tell us, how did Donald Trump, in your opinion, come about?
Sure. Well, there will be a book. I honestly wasn't really ready to sign on to do another one, but you're right. This election is it deserves to be chronicled, let's just put it mildly. So I would say Trump's success really depends on three factors at least, one of which is just having a very fractured field. So there's, you know, at most, I think, you know, 17 Republican candidates. None of them is sort of clearly preferred by a large number of the party, whether you're talking about the leaders or the voters. So, I mean, in some sense, he's competing in a field where there's no consensus on an alternative, and none really developed, or if it developed at all, it developed relatively late. The second thing is he gets, you know, a lot of news coverage, to put it mildly. And you've got, you know, as a candidate in a 17-person field, you know, news coverage is an important cue for voters about who they should be thinking about, who's a serious candidate, who's a viable candidate. And I think absent that level of coverage, it would have been harder for Trump to make a dent, and it would also have been easier for some other candidate to make a run at him. But I think Trump was so capable of dominating the news cycle on a regular basis that it just was difficult for one of the other 16 candidates to break out of the pack. Last thing is that Trump taps into significant currents of opinion within the party, and I think currents of opinion that some people were surprised by but have actually always been there. The fact that lots of Republicans aren't necessarily conservative ideologues, and Trump actually did better among Republicans who actually had more liberal views on some kinds of policy, views that were really not sort of out of step with what the congressional leadership, let's say, would have supported. And then he's also tapping into a strain of concern about immigration and sort of unfavorable views of lots of different minority groups. And I think there, you know, that's not necessarily enough to win a general election, as we may see, but it's enough to get a kind of plurality support within the party. And when, you know, and again, when no other candidate can really muster enough of what it takes to challenge you, you know, as we've seen, it's enough to win the nomination, or at least appear to win the nomination.
Yes, I'm going to ask one follow-up, and then I'm going to pass it to Catherine and Tim. And that would be, I heard, and you kind of alluded to it with number three, that, you know, Donald Trump's a straight talker. You know, John McCain may have the bus in 2000, the straight talk express, but a lot of people, they just say that, you know, Donald's, you know, saying what everybody's thinking. Now, I think that's a plurality of the Republican voters that might agree with that, but obviously enough to get him the nomination. Do you see anything there that he's just the, you know, tell it like it is, if you will?
I do think that's the brand he's kind of created for himself. Maybe that persona is part of it, but I also happen to think it's what he's saying. Right? It's not just that he's talking straight, it's that he's saying things that a particular segment of the party maybe already felt, frankly. So, when we've looked at some of the different surveys that are out there, we've found that, support for Trump is associated not just with concern about immigration, but with a sort of a perception that white people are under threat, that the changing demography of the country, the growing number of non-white people in this country is a problem. And so I do think that, straight talk is part of it, but I think at least when you look at what sort of factors are motivating people to support Trump, I think it really has to do more with some of the content of his message, of course, which is the very content that's now, has made so many in the party concerned about his chances of winning in November.
Yes, I'm going to go ahead and pass it to Catherine now. Catherine?
Thanks so much for being on tonight. We really appreciate it. I know it's Father's Day and everything, so. So this week, Donald Trump made some pretty outrageous remarks, and we saw some national people sort of step away a little bit, not as much as you might expect. But do you think there's anything he can say that will his supporters forgive him for anything that he might say? It seems like it to me. I'm kind of shocked that he can sort of say anything, and sometimes what he says isn't even true. And then people interview these supporters, and they go, oh, well, yeah, I know that's not true, but I still like him. I'm still voting for him. So do you think there's anything he can do that will, I mean, obviously not intentionally, but that he would do that would turn people off, his supporters off?
Sure. I mean, so I think one potential thing we'll learn from this election is sort of what is the floor of any major party candidate. Right. I mean, is it 45% of the vote? Is it 40% of the vote? What is it? I mean, and we live in an era in which partisanship and party loyalty are quite strong. So as you guys have seen, just in a typical presidential exit poll, we're talking about 90 or 92% of Democrats voting for the Democrat and the same thing for the Republicans. That was true, for example, in 2012. But Trump really puts that to the test. In terms of can he actually get that same level of support within the Republican Party? Does this kind of rhetoric alienate, independent voters to the extent that he's going to perform relatively poorly with them? You've seen in the last few weeks that his poll numbers have dropped maybe 5 points. And I think that's a meaningful consequence. So clearly they're not going to drop to nothing. I mean, he's going to get a substantial fraction of the vote. I think, almost any major party nominee will. But the interesting thing for me is kind of how low can he go? And the other dimension of it, too, is he's not getting any kind of necessarily energetic support within the broader party. People have endorsed him, but you can see how, qualified those endorsements are or how sort of unenthusiastic they are. Paul Ryan is a good example of this. He's not raising money. It's not clear that the party is going to be able to really sort of step in to help his campaign or want to step in to help his campaign. Are these donors going to step in and actually fundraise for him? I mean, Hillary Clinton's gone up with millions of dollars of advertising in the battleground states, and Donald Trump has $0 on the air right now. So to me is a signal like you could pay a cost, right, from saying the things that he said. It's not necessarily going to drive his November vote share down, below even 45%, let's say, but it's still enough to be costly. So the question, I guess, is sort of whether he's going to change his tactics, that hasn't happened thus far, or whether the party is going to, sort of hold their nose and support him no matter what.
Okay. Thank you. That's a new perspective that I hadn't thought about, so thank you. I'm going to pass it to Tim.
When you talk about seeing where the floor can be, I'm sitting here as we speak looking at a graph from the Washington Post, and it shows the percent of support for the past four Republican nominees. And Trump is well below any of the previous three. How low can this go?
As I, you know, I don't know if I can give you a number. It seems to me to be, you know, it's plausible that Clinton could beat him by 6 or 8 points. So think about, so Obama beats Romney by 4 points. So I could imagine doubling that. It's tough to imagine getting to landslide levels like 64 or 72. I mean, that would take that, you know, to get to that level, you've got to have a fourth of Republicans voting for Hillary Clinton, or so, you know, something equivalent
right.
to that. That's a pretty high number in an era in which the parties are as polarized as they are, and in which voters' social sort of loyalties, partisan loyalties, are as strong as they are. So I think a lot of commentators think we're probably not in an era where the landslides of that magnitude are possible. But it does seem to be the case that, you know, if you all remember back to 2012 and how sort of quickly that was over, and how demoralizing that was for Republicans, particularly those who sort of mistakenly thought that Romney had a really good chance of winning. You know, imagine losing by twice that amount, and I think it would be a pretty bad night, and it would be one that would at least occasion another round of discussion within the Republican Party about what went wrong and what they can do better. So that's, you know, that's an initial sense, but it probably stops short of figuring out exactly what that floor might be.
All right, let's go at this another way then. More and more in recent elections, voters have tended to lock together their presidential vote and their U.S. Senate choice in whatever state they might be in. How would an 8-point loss affect that this year? Or would voters be splitting their vote?
Yeah, it's a very good question, and it's one I think that a lot of Senate Republicans are pretty nervous about right now, because obviously the chance of losing a Senate majority is quite real. Losing a House majority would be less likely, although obviously the Democrats could still put a pretty good dent in the Republicans' majority. So I think there's a couple things that are of concern. One is that there's a documented phenomenon that you guys may have heard described as coattails, right, where the president pulls candidates into Congress on his coattails. So the better a presidential candidate does, the better the candidates in his party will do, like in Senate elections or other down-ballot elections. So, yeah, I mean, if given that that's a real phenomenon, it is absolutely a risk that if you're, you know, Mark Kirk running in Illinois, or you're Pat Toomey running in Pennsylvania, you know, you're running in these states that aren't even really red states to begin with. I mean, Russ Feingold's already, you know, got a lead in Wisconsin. You know, it's a serious concern. And even more, I think, of a concern is that back to the point about Trump not raising any money. I mean, he has like 30 staff doing field work for him, and Hillary Clinton has 800. So if you think about who's out there knocking on doors, making phone calls to remind voters to show up and vote, and you think about the voters that are, of course, are part of Trump's essential base, which is, you know, less well-educated whites, maybe not the group that's naturally as inclined to remember to vote in the first place. You know, he's got to do a lot of work to turn those people out. And for every voter that the presidential campaign's not turning out, right, that's a vote perhaps that the Senate group candidate has lost. So, you know, at the end of the day, again, like it's hard to quantify exactly what the what the impact of that is on the individual vote for any particular Senate candidate. But some of the forecasting work that's been done thus far has always suggested that the Democrats have a better than 50-50 chance of taking back the Senate. So certainly nothing about Trump's nomination is making that any better.
Uh-huh. Now, of course, in Donald Trump's alternate universe, in which he just, I don't know, just says whatever comes into his mind, he has stated categorically that because of the type of candidate he is, that he will be able to scramble the electoral map in ways that the more conventional Republican candidates could not. But obviously, conventional wisdom says otherwise. We know about the blue wall and the 242 electoral votes that the Democrats have received in, I believe, six straight elections now. So if we're looking at those states, would a state, say, like Pennsylvania be the most obvious place where Trump could break through?
My sense of the commentary is that I think a lot of people would put that close to the top of the list if that were if he's gonna make it happen. You would need to see it in a state like Philadelphia. One thing that's interesting though is that in Hillary Clinton's initial advertising buy, she did not buy any ads in Pennsylvania. Probably what that means is that their polling data doesn't give them any cause to be concerned yet. I don't want to read too much into that. You know, Romney spent a lot of ads and bought a lot of ads on Pennsylvania late, and people speculated that that meant that Pennsylvania was possibly in his grasp. But actually, after the fact, one of the Romney campaign staffers told me they bought ads in Pennsylvania because they had money to spend and there was no more advertising time anywhere else. You know, Ohio was full, you know, Florida was full.
Wow.
You had to do something with it. So, you know, we got to be careful, but I don't see it yet. I mean, the challenge for Trump, and this is not a prediction per se, but it's just showing you the challenge, is that from over time, it's become the tendency from election to election is for the states to swing in the same way by roughly similar amounts. So you don't see the map being scrambled from year to year. What you see is the map pretty much the same, except shifting, you know, a few points in the direction of either candidate, depending on how, you know, conditions in the country are and which party's favored to win the election. Now, there are a few examples of that. You know, Alaska swings a little harder towards the Republicans in 2008 when Palin's on the ticket. Utah swings harder to Romney in 2012 because he's Romney and he's a Mormon. But you don't see, I think less malleability in the map now than you might have seen 40 or 50 years ago. So to scramble the map, to take blue states and turn them red, or especially like one or two states like Pennsylvania, I think is a particularly challenging thing. The irony may be for Trump is that if the map is going to be scrambled, it might be scrambled in Clinton's favor. I'm sure you guys have seen the polling out of Utah, right?
Yes,
that puts
sir.
Them at, it puts them at a tie. The people are talking about Arizona. Now, my guess is if she's going to win Arizona and Utah, she's going to win almost – I mean, she's going to win a lot of states, right? So there's going to be a big swing in her favor. So it's not necessarily going to be a, you know, an isolated phenomenon in Utah, Arizona, but still, it, you know, it raises the possibility that if Trump cannot sort of turn it around and get his poll numbers, you know, moving in the opposite direction, you know, he's going to find himself playing defense all over the map, and these ideas that he has of competing in New York and California are going to look, you know, even more improbable. You know, I'm telling you right now, if he's going to lose Utah, he's not going to have any problems in New York or California.
All right, and with that, I will send it back to David. David?
Okay, well, Dr. Sides, I wanted to ask you, how much do you think, particularly for Hillary Clinton, that the election decisions are going to be made not so much on just electoral math of, you know, the old map, but she might actually look at how do I win the Senate, how do I win House seats? Like, for instance, let's say Kentucky were an 8-point divide and Tennessee were a 7. I know those aren't real players, but let's just say, you know, Tennessee looks closer, but Kentucky has a Senate seat, and there's some places where maybe House seats are major media markets that could flip. How much do you think she's going to look at that because she knows she needs to govern more so than just the simple, this is the way to add on to 270.
You know, it'd be really interesting to see. I think, you know, it hasn't been typical in the last few elections for candidates to be able to think that kind of that far down the road. But if she's in a position in which, you know, she's sort of comfortably ahead and Trump's playing defense in Utah, let's say, then it does make sense for her to think about where can I devote some effort in order to potentially make the congressional majorities or minorities a little bit more favorable to her. And that's actually, I think, not just a question for her, but it's a question for the Democratic Party, right? If you don't have to devote as much resources to the presidential race because it's reasonably well in hand, what can you do with that money? How can you spend it better in other places? Already, you know, you're seeing Republicans thinking through exactly that logic, right? So there's people like the Koch brothers, I think, who are saying, you know, I'm not quite sure we want to really spend much money in the presidential race now. It's not quite clear whether they support Trump to the extent that they would have supported another nominee. And so now they're talking about, well, let's just see if we can hold the Senate. And if that's the case, then it's all the more reason for Democrats to find ways to counteract that effort and put as many of these seats, you know, potentially in their hands as they can. But that would be a real luxury if you think about it for a presidential candidate, right? Even Obama in 2008, I don't think, was thinking about that kind of calculation, and it was clearly conditions that were going to be very, very difficult for a Republican to win. So it'd be interesting to see if Clinton can find some ways to do that. I mean, I think that's the real challenge for the Democratic Party is, you know, if you think about it this way, let's just say she wins the presidency, that's really good news. That's probably going to be accompanied by some Senate seats and some House seats. But we know that in 2018, the sheer fact of having a Democratic president in the White House is going to make it harder for Democrats to win seats in the midterm, just like it was harder for Obama to win seats in 2010, 2014. Bush, the Republicans, lost seats in 2006. So, you know, to the extent that she can build these majorities as large as she can, it's giving her some insulation, I think, against what might be a kind of a typical decline for the president's party in the midterm.
Yes. And the final question I had for you, you know, you being a professor at George Washington University, it seemed appropriate. There was a political article earlier in the week saying that Paul Ryan and the GOP House is studying ways to kind of amend the Constitution to take power back from the president. Now, obviously, they couldn't enact anything under President Obama, so I guess this is not solely directed towards him, but they could be looking at, hey, if Hillary Clinton wins or in the future any other Democrat, and we have more of an advantage on those off years, and particularly the House, if we can somehow change the Constitution to favor us, that will help us. Just from a constitutional view, the long view, not, you know, this current time we live in, but decades down the road, how important do you think this is?
You know, I think that obviously they're doing anything at a constitutional level is a huge uphill battle that's not really likely to succeed. But I do think there's some interesting conversation going on in Washington about congressional power. And congressional capacity. So take the party dimension out of it for a minute, and don't think of it as, you know, Republicans in Congress trying to figure out how to stick it to Hillary Clinton if she's the president. They may be trying to do that. Don't get me wrong. They may be trying to do that. But this conversation is a little bit different. This conversation is basically saying, look, over time, Congress has actually reduced the number of staff that work for it. This started in particular under Gingrich when he became the speaker in 1994. It's reduced the number of staff. You know, they're not paid all that well relative to what they can make being a lobbyist or what have you. And so in some sense, Congress has seen a bit of a brain drain. It's not really developing the capacity it needs to legislate and to hold the president and the executive branch accountable for their decisions. Meanwhile, we're living in an era, as you guys have seen, particularly under Bush, but continuing under Obama, I think, where because of national security concerns, you know, presidents have sort of made a lot of unilateral decisions, sort of try to centralize power in the White House. And I think I'm listening to both to kind of liberals that you would expect to want Congress to be able to do stuff, but I'm also hearing conservatives express some concern and say, you know, we need to develop a theory of Congress, not just a theory of the executive. We need to be able to say why Article 1 of the Constitution actually does matter, and we need to be investing in Congress. And that sort of goes against a certain amount of Republican thinking, because that makes, what do you mean? You're going to make government bigger? You're going to give members of Congress more staff? But that might be the idea if those staff are actually invested in doing policymaking, not just invested in sending tweets for members of Congress, which is what a lot of staff have to do these days. So I think it's an interesting time to think about whether we might be looking at a Congress that tries to reassert itself, not just in terms of the Republican majority, but in terms of an institution that's trying to, you know, kind of retain authority in a system in which sometimes the president seems to be the lead actor.
Okay. Well, as this thing unfolds, should it have more layers, we'll definitely want to have you back to give more input, because I have a feeling between now and November it's going to be election and this is going to hit the back burner. Catherine, Tim, any quick questions for Dr. Sides before I let him go?
Not me. I do have one, Dr. Sides. As we look at what's going on in the country right now, and I know this has been talked about for a long time, but are we finally to the point in our political process where we could be looking at the formation soon of a significant third-party movement in this country?
It's a very good question. A couple thoughts on that. One is that it seems like there's at least this year, there's a better chance for a third party to do a little bit better than usual. Now, that's a kind of a qualified statement, right? But that's the way to think about it. So, probably the Libertarian ticket's the most likely to pick up. You know, so the chance that the Libertarian ticket gets, let's say, 5% of the vote, or some sort of third party gets 5% of the vote. I think there's a better chance this year. It's probably not even odds yet, but it's a better chance this year. Now, I don't know that that's a springboard for, you know, a real successful run at the two major parties. But I do think that that may be one possible consequence of this year, particularly with Trump as the Republican nominee. Over the long haul, I think the real interesting question is whether the Republican Party can kind of overcome some of the cleavages that have manifested this election, one of which is, you know, about immigration, clearly, but that was going to be an issue no matter what, no matter if Trump hadn't run. You were going to see Rubio and Bush and Cruz argue about that issue, for example. I think the party's got some real work to do to overcome that cleavage. And, if the party can't do that, right, if these kinds of cleavages where you're going to – I don't know how you want to divide the party, right, establishment versus conservatives, or establishment and the conservatives and the populists, or however you want to do it. I think, there's the potential for some longer-term fracturing, which would be remarkable, right, because it hasn't happened since 1860.
Right.
It's been a long time with these two parties. I mean, there were the progressives and there were the Dixiecrats and there was, Ross Perot or whatever that was. But, it's not those have been very sort of on the scene and off the scene again. We haven't seen that big kind of transformation. So, that's the interesting question that you'd want to figure out. And I think in particular, if it's sort of Trump that's going to be the fracturing force, I think the real question is not so much how well Trump does or what he decides to do after he runs, but I think the bigger question is, are there interest groups within the party that want to pick up Trump's agenda and run with it? And that to me is the biggest challenge facing the sort of populist, any kind of populist force within the party. We can sit here and name the establishment interest groups, right? Chamber of Commerce. We can sit here and name interest groups that are important with regard to particular issues like the NRA and gun control. But if you want to say to me what is the set of interest groups in the Republican Party that want to limit immigration but also expand the welfare state, or at least preserve the welfare state, and seem to be okay with Planned Parenthood and maybe also with transgender bathrooms, I don't know who those interest groups are, right? So, in some sense, like, Trump's kind of hodgepodge of issue positions, to the extent that he has these, sort of well-formed issue positions, doesn't lend itself well to sort of a third party exactly, right? It's just a weird combination of views relative to what's in the party as a whole. So, I mean, clearly I think the Republican Party has work to do. I'm not yet ready to say we're in for a wholesale fracturing of the party, but I think this election, even maybe more so than 2012, has laid bare what those challenges are for the party in terms of kind of unifying itself and making progress on these issues where, you know, clearly it's going to be challenging for them to win presidential elections without, you know,
yes,
bringing on board a few, you know, Latinos and some other non-white voters.
Yes, sir. All right. Thank you, Dr. David.
Yes. Well, Dr. Sides, thanks so much for coming to the Kudzu. Before we let you go, if you want to tell people where they can read your blog, follow you on Twitter, any other social media you want to promote, now's your chance.
Well, you can follow the Monkey Cage on the Washington Post site. Just Google the Monkey Cage, and it'll be the first thing that pops up on the post. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, we are at Monkey Cage Blog.
All right. Well,
thanks
everybody. For being on, and we hope that we can get you back soon.
Great. David, Tim, Catherine, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doctor.
Yeah. Take care.
And with that, that's been the Kudzu Bomb for tonight. So good night, everybody.
Happy Father's Day, guys.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Thank you.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force?